The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated November 8/November 15, 2021. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow inner border of white. Time in large block capital letters is white, superimposed upon a pale blue background. Standing within this background is a man. It's a portrait of a man, neither smiling nor frowning, but looking straight at the camera lens. He wears a dark blue suit, a white shirt, and a blue and white patterned tie. One of his hands is visible in this photo, and they are veined and wrinkled, as one would expect that to be of an elder. He has quite a lot of gray hair. His eyes are light blue, presumably, or perhaps a light blue-green. It is the diplomat, John Kerry, brings America back into the climate fight. We'll begin now with For the Record, with a few short items. To be specific, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 short items. Every day the court fails to grant relief is devastating. This by Sonia Sotomayor, U.S. Supreme Court Justice. In her dissent to the court's October 22 decision to keep Texas' six-week abortion ban in place until it rules on the legality of its controversial enforcement structure. The word victim is a loaded, loaded word. Judge Bruce Schroeder says, ruling October 25 that attorneys could refer to people shot by Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha, Wisconsin, last year as looters and arsonists, but not as victims during Rittenhouse's murder trial. 35,000, the number of newly designed Ohio license plates that will be recycled after it was revealed October 21 that the plane on the plate paying homage to Dayton natives Orville and Wilbur Wright is pictured pushing a banner. Female astronauts may be in better condition after putting on makeup, by Peng Zhihao, a China National Space Administration official, in October 17, remarks confirming cosmetics were sent into space for Colonel Wang Yaping. Having my records expunged will mean something to my grandchildren and great-grandchildren, stated by Claudette Colvin, a civil rights activist, in a sworn October 27 statement asking that the record of her 1955 arrest for refusing to give up her seat on a segregated bus be cleared. I acknowledge that there are various opinions about our marriage, by Princess Mako, or Mako, M-A-K-O, in prepared remarks October 26, as she married Commoner K. Komuro in Tokyo, forfeiting her royal titles. 1021 A.D. year to which scientists have radiocarbon dated a Viking settlement in Newfoundland, Canada, indicating the presence of Europeans in the Americas more than four centuries before Columbus, according to a study published October 20. Good news of the week. October 27, the U.S. government announced it had issued its first passport with an X gender marker in a historic move for the rights of non-binary, intersex, and gender non-conforming people. In the brief opener, headlined Health, a new push for COVID-19's roots by Jamie Ducharme. Almost 2 years into the COVID-19 pandemic, as booster shots roll out and this summer's Delta-related surge subsides in the U.S., it is still not clear exactly how, where, or when SARS-CoV-2 began infecting people. Many experts believe the virus jumped from animal hosts to humans, but researchers continue to investigate the possibility it escaped from a laboratory. The chances of figuring out which, if either, of those theories is correct grow slimmer as time passes. But on October 13, the World Health Organization, WHO, revealed a new effort to capitalize on what time remains. The Scientific Advisory Group for the Origins of Novel Pathogens, SAGO, an advisory group of international experts from specialties including epidemiology, virology, genomics, tropical medicine, public health, and animal health. The group is tasked with learning what it can about SARS-CoV-2 while streamlining the study of future emerging pathogens in hopes of more quickly understanding their origins and transmission so they can be contained. But its first assignment will be bringing new life to the largely stalled investigation of COVID-19's origins, an investigation that politicians, world leaders, and countless members of the public have long put pressure on the WHO to deliver. It may be too late. Trying to reverse engineer a virus's origins 2 years into the pandemic it caused is like going back to the scene of a crime 2 years later and the crime scene has been scrubbed, says Lawrence Gostin, a professor of global health law at Georgetown University, who has served on numerous WHO advisory committees. That does not mean it is not worth trying. When cases of what we now know to be COVID-19 were first reported near Wuhan, China, in late 2019, the cluster seemed to be linked to an animal market. But as time went on, some experts asked whether the virus could have been lab-made. Others noted that it could have been circulating, undetected, well before its existence became public knowledge, perhaps first infecting people outside the Wuhan area. Scientists and elected officials from around the world called for an independent investigation into the virus's origins. Chinese officials initially resisted those calls, but eventually let in a WHO-led mission January 2021. The team's findings, published in a March report, were inconclusive, sparking widespread consternation. 14 countries, including the U.S., released a joint statement calling the report significantly delayed and lacking access to complete original data and samples. WHO officials and researchers later said China withheld data from the investigators. In July, China rejected the WHO's plans for a second effort, which would have included further research into the possibility of a lab leak. Chinese officials have repeatedly denied that any such leak occurred. "We will not accept such an origins tracing plan, as it, in some aspects, disregards common sense and defies science. The Vice Minister of China's National Health Commission told reporters, SAGO's work will not include another mission to China, says Maria van Kerkhove, who leads the WHO's Emerging Diseases and Zoonoses Unit. The group's job is not to conduct field research, she explains, but rather to review existing science and advise the WHO and its member states about what to do next. It is not about blame. It is not about pointing fingers. It is about being better prepared for next time, Van Kerkhove continues. Let's say another disease emerges tomorrow. This group can come together and take whatever information we have, whatever we know about the cluster or the case, and advise these things need to happen right now. Georgetown's Gostin says a standing committee with the sole purpose of investigating new pathogens will make it easier to find answers in the future, but he doubts it will push the SARS-CoV-2 investigation forward. The WHO cannot compel countries to give unfettered access to its researchers, and it may be too late for effective cooperation when it comes to COVID-19. The same structural barriers are in place, Gostin says. As far as China is concerned, the investigation is over. Here's a graphic added to this page, and it says, "Am I eligible for a booster?" If you are 18 or older and your first dose was. Now, this is segmented into two columns, one for Moderna or Pfizer-BioNTech, another for Johnson & Johnson. So, first of all, reading down the column headed by Moderna or Pfizer-BioNTech, if you, and your first dose was, you had a second dose of the same vaccine about a month later. Are you any of the following? 65 or older, have an underlying medical condition, work or live in a high-risk setting, that is, a long-term care facility. If you answered, pardon me, if you answered yes to those questions, you go on. And it says, are you immunocompromised? And if you answer yes to that, it says, a third dose of the same shot is recommended as soon as 4 weeks after the second, though Moderna and Pfizer can be interchanged if necessary. If you answered no to the above questions, has it been at least 6 months since your second dose? And you answer yes, it says, you are booster eligible. You can receive a half-dose Moderna shot or a Pfizer shot or a J&J shot. But if you answered no to those questions, no booster yet. Now, moving on to the Johnson & Johnson column. If you are 18 or older and your first dose was Johnson & Johnson, you had only a single shot. Has it been at least 2 months since your first shot? If you answer no, it's no booster yet. If you answered yes, you are booster eligible. You can receive a half-dose Moderna shot or a Pfizer shot or a J&J shot. Returning to three brief articles under the brief heading. News ticker, military coup in Sudan ousts government. Sudan's military retook control of the country in an October 25 coup, jailing Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok and deposing a transitional government weeks before it was to transfer control to civilians. The group undid fragile progress made after massive protests brought down the last military-led government in 2019. Pig kidney transplant successful. Surgeons in New York City announced October 21 they had attached a kidney grown in a genetically altered pig to a brain-dead human patient, where it worked normally for 54 hours. As the first successful operation of its kind, it could suggest a path forward for accessing organs for transplant patients. Bolsonaro may face COVID charges. A committee of Brazilian senators recommended October 26 that President Jair Bolsonaro be criminally charged for his handling of COVID-19, which has left Brazil with the world's second highest death toll. The recommended charges include crimes against humanity and charlatanism. There's a photo here. It's in color, although it's mostly in dark shades. There's a plume of very dark smoke pouring out above very dark mountains. There's a dark tree limb or bough of green superimposed upon a rather bright blue sky behind all of this darkness. In the foreground, then, there are two men dressed casually, both wearing masks, and they're carrying a beer of a type. Higher power. Villagers on the island of La Palma in the Canaries carry a statue of their patron saint, the Virgen del Pino, October 19, praying for an end to a now month-long eruption. The Canary Islands Volcanology Institute confirmed October 25 that portions of the Cumbre Viejas volcanic core have collapsed, spewing out new lava flows that threaten more of La Palma's banana crop and will likely force thousands more to evacuate. The subject of the statue appears to be dressed in gold with a halo attached to its head. In front of the statue, which based upon the approximate height of the men must be 3 or 4 feet, and of course it is elevated on this platform which the men carry. In front of the gold-clad statue is a beautiful array of large yellow chrysanthemums. Bulletin. Facebook's dramatic fall from grace continues. A more complete portrait of how Facebook has been vividly aware of its harmful effects came to light October 25 via a series of reports on internal Facebook documents leaked to the media by whistleblower Francis Haugen. On the same day, Haugen testified in front of British lawmakers shaping new big tech legislation. Mark Zuckerberg has unilateral control over 3 billion people, Haugen said. There's no will at the top to make sure these systems are run in an adequately safe way. Facebook papers. Damning details from the leaked documents have revealed Facebook's problems with hate speech and disinformation are dramatically worse in the developing world. The social network has long underinvested in building safety systems for languages spoken outside North America and Europe. October 25, Zuckerberg called the coverage based on Haugen's leaks a coordinated effort to selectively use leaked documents to paint a false picture of our company. Regulatory plans. Haugen has embarked on an extensive tour of Europe, where lawmakers have been far more aggressive than the U.S. in regulating big tech. European Union rules on data protection forced changes in 2018 that also protected American users, and coming regulations would compel platforms to regulate content. Haugen said she hoped her testimony could shape that incoming regulation to better reflect how social platforms actually work on the inside. Bottom lines. Wall Street, it seems, still believes Facebook can weather the storm. The company's stock price has slipped in recent weeks, but is still historically high. In its third-quarter earnings call, Facebook announced its profits are projected to rise 39% year over year in 2021. But although investors have proved unwilling to force Facebook to change course, Hogan's documents and now testimony may yet force a different kind of reckoning. That article was by Billy Perigo and Nick Popley. The brief news, more news tickers, three more here. FDA panel, COVID vaccine okay for kids. An advisory committee, October 26, recommended the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approve the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 5 to 11, a day after the drug company Moderna announced its COVID-19 vaccine is safe and efficacious for children ages 6 to 11. Human rights group exits Hong Kong. The prominent human rights group Amnesty International announced October 25 it would close its offices in Hong Kong by the end of the year, citing the national security law imposed on the city by Beijing in 2020, which restricts freedom of expression. UK lawmaker killing suspect charged. British police charged a 25-year-old man with murder and terrorism-related offenses October 21 in relation to the killing of David Ames, A-M-E-S-S, 69, a conservative parliamentarian, stabbed to death while meeting constituents October 15. Prosecutors said Ali Harbi Ali, a Briton with Somali heritage, had been plotting to kill a politician for 2 years. The brief news. Good question. Are America's leaders growing too old to serve? This is by Charlotte Alter. They say wisdom comes with age, yet so few of the nation's leaders seem to have the wisdom to know when it is time to call it a day. At some point, and statistically it's in the 80s, you begin a more rapid decline, Republican Senator Bill Cassidy told Axios on HBO in an interview airing October 17. So anybody in a position of responsibility who may potentially be on that slope, that is of concern. And I'm saying this as a doctor. At 78, President Joe Biden has faced attacks on his mental fitness, as did his septuagenarian predecessor, Donald Trump. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is still negotiating reconciliation packages at 81, while the Senate's top Republican, Mitch McConnell, is still trying to block them at 79. And Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, 88, is planning to run for re-election next year. If he wins, he could be nearly a century old by the time he finishes that term. Cassidy, who's 64, made clear he was not singling out anyone in particular. Would it be reasonable to have for Supreme Court justices, members of Congress, and leadership positions in the executive branch an annual sort of evaluation in which they would have to establish, yes, I'm doing okay? Cassidy continued, noting he had heard of senile senators. I think that is actually a reasonable plan. Some 30 states have age-based driver's license renewal requirements, including many that require seniors over 70 to take extra tests or reapply in person. That standard would apply to nearly 30% of the Senate, except you do not have to prove mental acuity to continue driving the country. Cassidy is not wrong, says Amanda Littman, who usually disagrees with him on politics. Littman co-founded Run for Something, which recruits and trains young Democrats as state and local candidates. The advanced age of elected officials is a huge problem, she adds. It is an open secret, and it directly affects the way the government functions. One bad slip on a too-polished floor could break not only a hip, but a majority, crumple a president's agenda, or upset the balance of power. When then 80-year-old Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont was briefly hospitalized in January, it sent tremors through the Democratic caucus, which could not afford to lose a single member in a 50-50 Senate. A reigning gerontocracy also means the priorities of younger people, who had record turnout in the last two elections, can get ignored. Already, tuition-free college has been nixed from the Democrat spending bill, and climate change provisions are in jeopardy. The problems of young Americans are just a lot different now than when a lot of the folks in Congress were our age, says Maxwell Alejandro Frost, a 24-year-old former March for Our Lives organizer who's running for Congress in Florida. I do think there is an age at which people just become out of touch with things. Finally, on this page under Nature, Animal Instincts. On October 15, a federal judge ruled that the descendants of hippos smuggled into Colombia by drug kingpin Pablo Escobar have the legal rights of people, the first ruling of its kind in the U.S. Here, more creatures in court. This small article by Madeline Carlisle. Orangutans. In 2015, an Argentine judge granted legal personhood to Sandra, a hybrid Bornean and Sumatran orangutan who had lived in the Buenos Aires Zoo for two decades. At the judge's direction, Sandra was moved to a sanctuary in the U.S. in 2019. Orcas. The animal rights group PETA sued SeaWorld in 2011, arguing five captured orcas, including Tilikum, the killer whale featured in the documentary Blackfish, deserved protection under the 13th Amendment's ban on slavery. But in 2013, a judge ruled the law did not apply. Arctic foxes. October 25. The Icelandic police raided the home of a man allegedly raising an Arctic fox. He had named Gusti Jr. While the country's laws ban people from owning wild animals as pets, Gusti's owner argues his fox should not be classified in that way. Milestones. Died Jerry Pinkney brought black beauty to life. By Jason Reynolds. Children's book illustrator Jerry Pinkney, who died October 20 at the age of 81, was a cultural touchstone. Whether with tales of the Reverend Martin Luther King or black cowboys, I do not know if anyone has accomplished bringing black history and culture and black beauty to life through illustrations with the consistency and vigor that Pinkney did, and for as long as he did. Among his most stunning works was The Lion and the Mouse, an adaptation of the classic Aesop fable, which in 2010 won the Randolph Caldecott Medal for Outstanding Illustration. Pinkney's work always had a certain kind of whimsy to me, which is so rare when it comes to the representation of black people. I think our lives are often thought of as heavily laden. Pinkney's work is about showing us, even in our toughest moments, with a certain element of light. When I look at his illustrations, I do not feel the weight of our history. I know it's there, but it does not feel like that. It feels lighter. Pinkney has surely inspired and spawned hundreds of black artists. We talk about legacy so cavalierly these days, but we have to acknowledge Jerry Pinkney will go down as a legend. The thing about black illustrations in children's books is that they create a palette for children. The first art they see is in those books. They create taste. Reynolds, who wrote this article, is an award-winning author and current Library of Congress National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. And here's a photo of Pinkney at work in his home studio, August 6, 2001. Well, he's working under quite an intense light on a drafting or drawing table. He has a large sheet of paper that he appears to be working on in watercolors. It's upside down, so I cannot describe it to you, but he's intent in his work. He's wearing a blue denim or chambray shirt. He has short cropped hair, tan skin, glasses, and facial hair. Here's another dyed, James Michael Tyler. James Michael Tyler, who played the scene-stealing Central Park barista Gunther on all 10 seasons of the NBC sitcom Friends, died October 24 at the age of 59. Tyler was working at a real coffee shop in L.A. in 1994 when he snagged the part. He began as a background actor, but leveraged small moments of mooning after Jennifer Aniston's Rachel into a long-running gag. In his most iconic scenes, Tyler, a talented physical comedian, often did not speak, but rather glowered at Rachel's love interests, in particular Ross, David Schwimmer, or endured scratches from her demonic cat. In time, Tyler became the honorary seventh friend. By its finale in 2004, he had appeared in a majority of Friends' 236 episodes. Tyler's doctor diagnosed his prostate cancer during a routine checkup in 2018, and he dedicated the last years of his life to spreading awareness about cancer screenings. "My goal this past year was to see my 59th birthday. I did that," he said on the Today Show in June. "My goal now is to at least save one life." Eliana Doctorman wrote that article, and there is a photo of Tyler at a Friends anniversary event in 2014. He's wearing a blue shirt. He's standing by a marble top, or it looks marble top, counter, and behind him are various, I guess, specialty coffee brands and a big contraption that might be an espresso machine. Another indication here of a dyed former South Korean president, Roh Tae-woo, who ruled the country from 1988 to 1993. At 88, October 26, and Mort Sahl, S-A-H-L, stand-up comedian and satirist, at 94, October 26. Elected Sandra Mason as first president of Barbados, who in November will replace Queen Elizabeth II as the country's head of state, October 20, in a break from the island's colonial past. Detected a potential exoplanet 28 million light years away in the Whirlpool Galaxy. The first identified outside our galaxy, the Milky Way, according to an October 25 NASA press release. Kidnapped a group of 17 missionaries and family members in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, October 16. The gang, believed to be responsible, has asked for a $17 million ransom payment. Filed a lawsuit October 19 by a woman seeking $5 million from the cereal brand Kellogg's for allegedly misleading customers over how much strawberry its strawberry Pop-Tarts actually contain. Climate is everything is this section. It contains a few different articles. We're focusing now on an American diplomat in Scotland. There's a headshot on a page. The headshot looks like it's been extracted from that front cover portrait of John Kerry. And again, his eyes are blue. His hair is gray. He has a lot of it. He is wearing a blue suit. We see here only the lapels and the white shirt collar and the top of the blue and white patterned. It looks like China. I can't think of the name of it, that Dutch blue and white China. And it's called The Optimist's Challenge by Justin Warland, Naples, Italy. John Kerry can feel the heat. It's a sunny mid-July day in Naples, Italy, and we're sitting on the roof of his hotel overlooking the Mediterranean. By the way, the photograph of Kerry was by Peter Hapak, H-A-P-A-K, for Time. As tourists on the other side of the patio snap photos of Mount Vesuvius looming in the background, Kerry is warning about the fate of human life on Earth. Kerry, 77, has been on the public stage for decades as a senator, presidential candidate, and U.S. Secretary of State. And on paper, his latest role representing the U.S. as President Biden's climate envoy may look like a demotion, but Kerry rejects any question about why he has taken this role. The fate of civilization's on the line, and he will do anything he can to help. I have fought around war and peace, and that was life and death. This is already life and death, and in growing terms, he says. This is existential, and we need to behave like it. Despite the stifling heat and humidity, the lobby of the Excelsior Hotel, several stories below, is brimming with life unthinkable just a few months before. Chatter in Arabic, Dutch, and Japanese can all be detected among the cadre of diplomats who've descended here for a gathering of energy and climate ministers from the world's biggest economies. It is a key meeting in the year-long slog to COP26, the UN climate conference set to take place in Glasgow now. A few miles away in the city center, thousands of protesters are marching and chanting, insistent that official proceedings are not moving fast enough. System change. Another world is possible, one sign reads. The stakes are existential, but the debates at the Excelsior can seem pedantic. In one conference room, negotiators are tussling over the wording of how countries should submit new climate plans. On the roof, I ask Kerry about the various conflicts that some fear might scuttle the COP26 talks. The U.S. rift with China, Europe's plan to tax climate laggards, and the demands from developing nations that their rich counterparts do more. Kerry takes each one in stride, responding to every question with optimism that reason will prevail. I've always believed in diplomacy, he says. I believe in the ability of people to sit down and to try to work reasonably together. In the frenzied 24-plus hours of talks that followed, Kerry's team sought to put that mantra into action, refusing to let the two-day conference end without an agreement. The results were mixed. The U.S. helped broker a key compromise to affirm the country's broad commitment to ambitious climate-fighting measures, but could not win universal agreement on a specific commitment to phase out coal. This year, the fate of our civilization is being determined in bland convention center meeting spaces, slick corporate boardrooms, and regal hotel ballrooms. And wherever you go, it is hard to escape Kerry's name. That is, of course, K-E-R-R-Y. He comes up in conversations with the diplomats, legislators, and business personalities on the inside, as well as with the activists looking in. The dynamic is, in part, a testament to Kerry's role as an elder statesman who's greeted with open arms by heads of government in foreign capitals. But it is also a recognition that even after a Trump presidency that stomped on diplomacy and global norms, governments want the multilateral system to work. And for the U.S., which wrote the rules of the road in the aftermath of World War II, to do its part and remain an essential player. On the road, Kerry has clearly boiled down the U.S. mission. His country wants to keep the world from surpassing 1.5 degrees centigrade global temperature rise above pre-industrial levels. Temperatures have already risen 1.1 degrees centigrade And scientists say meeting that goal requires dramatic action right now. The 1.5 degree centigrade marker has come to represent the point where we are likely to face the worst effects of climate change, a reality often assessed in feet of sea level rise, days of drought, and the cost of storms. But the now decades-long failure to adequately address climate change has also placed the multilateral system and the U.S.'s place in it at risk. If nations do not come together, not only do U.S. leadership and democratic governance suffer, but the resulting disorder caused by those storms, droughts, and so much more will also force a transition to something new. It is hard to imagine someone more fitting to defend multilateralism than Kerry, a Vietnam veteran turned anti-war activist and son of a diplomat who has served at the highest levels of the U.S. government for decades. Kerry speaks carefully, not wanting to overstep his climate mandate, but understands the stakes. "We are fighting for everything here," he says. "It is not just the climate. It is fighting for a reasonable response by governance, for a reasonable relationship with our fellow citizens or non-citizens, a reasonable relationship with people in the world." Over the past 8 months, time has followed Kerry on that mission, first via telephone calls and virtual events, and then, as vaccination became widespread and travel returned, in person on both sides of the Atlantic. Kerry makes a robust case for the constructive role he, his government, and indeed good diplomacy have played in the lead-up to this year's climate conference. But to measure Kerry's success by the list of deals and announcements he brings to COP26 would be premature. The real test will come in the weeks and months to come, not just for Kerry, but for the world. On the late-night train from Geneva to Milan in late September, long after it has mostly cleared out, Kerry's taking a break from his briefing book and following each station stop intently, reflecting on the Alpine geography, and noting with excitement when we cross the border into Italy. He offers me candy from his favorite and oft-visited chocolate shop in Geneva. Kerry is an internationalist. When many leaders are looking inward, he knows where to stop for chocolate in foreign cities, yes, but he also has a vision of solving problems through diplomacy and deal-making. The son of a Foreign Service officer, he grew up on both sides of the Atlantic, at a time when the U.S. was working to rebuild Europe, attending boarding school in Switzerland before returning to the U.S. for high school. "I grew up very used to other cultures, other countries, other points of view," he tells me. "I did not view things exclusively through an American lens." From the beginning of his political career, Kerry found himself drawn to both environmental issues and foreign affairs, something he attributes to his transatlantic upbringing, and a mother, he says, was devoted to green issues. And throughout his career, he's tried to prioritize climate change, even as it remained on the broader political back burner. In 1992, he traveled to the Rio Earth Summit, the first UN climate meeting, to advocate for global climate solutions. He had his first significant conversation with his wife, Teresa Heinz Kerry, on the sidelines of the meeting, where she was impressed by his singing in her native Portuguese. In the Senate, he worked publicly to build a bipartisan coalition to pass climate legislation that would have capped U.S. emissions while working behind the scenes on efforts to educate his colleagues on the urgency of climate science. "He came at this with a lot of personal determination," says Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democratic senator from Rhode Island. China, without question, was the most important G20 nation to pursue. The country's the world's largest emitter and second largest economy. And although China has committed to peaking and then declining its emissions by 2030, Scientists say it needs to happen sooner to keep the world in line with the 1.5 degree centigrade goal. From his first months as Secretary of State under Obama, Kerry set out to build a bridge to China on climate, while tensions festered on other matters, putting the issue at the center of the relationship. In 2014 in Beijing, Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Barack Obama, with Kerry at his side, announced agenda-setting plans to cut emissions, effectively inviting other countries to get on the same page. On the back of Kerry's climate diplomacy, Obama and Xi feted each other a year later at a state dinner in Washington, perhaps the zenith of relations between the two countries in recent years. In the early days of the Biden administration, longtime watchers of international climate politics speculated about whether Kerry would try to repeat the effort. Kerry told me that from the outset he knew that would not be possible. The Trump presidency had spoiled the well, and while less vociferous, Biden has not sought to placate China. It is a very, very different time now, Kerry says. It is a very different set of political circumstances. Instead, he sought a subtler form of rapprochement, traveling to China in April, becoming the first senior U.S. official to visit since the start of the pandemic. His message, he says, was to create a lane for climate collaboration amid the iciness. The reception was a sharp contrast from the jubilant atmosphere at the state dinner 6 years earlier. The two parties released a joint statement, agreeing to cooperate but not much more. Then in September, after making the 7,000-mile trip to Tianjin, Kerry encountered even more tense feelings. Despite the long journey, China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi only met with him virtually and said climate collaboration could not be an oasis away from the other rifts in the relationship. If the oasis is surrounded by desert, sooner or later the oasis will also become desert, he said. Nonetheless, Kerry remains optimistic. He has met with his counterpart Xi Jinhua more than two dozen times and insists China remains essential to the U.S. strategy. But his approach has necessarily been to give the country space. They will not get pushed, he says. If you publicly are trying to hash this out, it is going to work against you. John Kerry is doing his best, but Congress may or may not fulfill the climate commitments, says Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, who now works on climate issues as the chair of the Elders, an NGO led by prominent former officials. Whatever happens in Congress, Kerry is confronting a challenge, a challenging reality. For three decades, U.S. engagement with international climate efforts has seesawed with each new administration. No matter how much cachet Kerry has on the global stage, the world is unsure how much it can trust the U.S. and whether the system it helped establish is actually working. Entirely outside the substance of climate, Glasgow is a test case for whether American leadership is still a force to be reckoned with, says White House, the senator from Rhode Island. If we cannot be a part of the solution now, and climate gets really out of hand, everybody in the world is going to look at what happened in the U.S., and it is not a good story. We arrive in Milan at nearly 11 at night. With one exception, Kerry and three of his advisors are the only people left in the sleepy train car. Kerry reaches for his old-school Orvis suitcase, worse for the wear after many of these trips, and lugs it through the Grand train station to a waiting car. For the past few days, Milan has played host to a youth climate summit, bringing together young people from around the world to come up with their own demands about how to address climate change, and then present them to ministers and senior government officials. The next morning, Carey joins his counterparts on the stage of the primary convention hall, surrounded by hundreds of youth climate activists seated in a semicircle surrounding the stage. Despite the gesture of open communication made by the international climate negotiators, an undercurrent of anger and dissatisfaction is palpable. Earlier that morning, youth protesters had interrupted Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, and police had escorted them outside. During the conference, a crowd of protesters chanted outside, while others spray-painted graffiti on the convention hall. A few days prior, Greta Thunberg had summed up the sentiment from the same stage, calling climate action leading up to the talks a bunch of blah, blah, blah. Empty rhetoric while the world burns. Facing the youth, Kerry did not turn defensive. If anything, he seemed to join in. With no notes and no teleprompter, for 7 minutes he described the climate battle as a fight for our lives, condemned the BS of laggards, and called out the powerful interests that want to continue business as usual. He said that developed countries are failing to help their poorer counterparts in financing the transition. He invoked the Holocaust to remind people that the world once said never again, and yet we're letting millions die from air pollution, extreme heat, and other climate change-related tragedies. This is an existential battle, he says, and for some people in the world it already is absolutely existential. They are losing their lives. The next day I asked Kerry whether he sees himself in the youth activists. After all, before he held any elected office, Kerry was a combat veteran, turned anti-war activist who took to the streets to protest Vietnam. I do not feel separated from them at all, he says. I feel like the same person I was in terms of my activism, frustration, motivation. I would probably be sitting there now if I was 18 years old. I sort of feel like I'm playing the same role here. I'm pushing, trying to lay out what I believe is the basic truth about climate. If the stakes are existential for the planet, so too are the stakes for U.S. leadership on it and the entire multilateral system that organizes relations between countries and people. On multiple occasions, Kerry brings this up to me without my prompting. This is what we built after World War II, a community of nations engaged with each other, he told me in Naples. And we've done lots to try to live up to that. We have pushed frontiers of solving problems. And here is the biggest problem of all. And we have not pushed the frontier sufficiently at all. Kerry's known for his optimism. People often portray him as the hard-charging diplomat, determined to get the deal and certain in his ability to deliver. That personality trait is evident, watching him in action and in conversation. But it's just as clear when listening to him grapple with the science that he does not see another option. I think you have to be an optimist to continue the fight, says David McLean, who served as Kerry's chief of staff in the Senate and later in a senior role in the State Department under Kerry. So I think he is an optimist, but first and foremost, I think he is realist. When I leave the conference center in Milan, where I had just wrapped up what I knew would be my last conversation with Kerry for this story, I take a walk in the nearby park, a pristinely landscaped public space that abuts a shiny shopping center. Workers are scrubbing the graffiti in big red letters that adorn the space, but most of it remains legible. Climate extinction, one says. Crime scene, says another. In the center of a wide open space, on the wall of a little cement structure, COP26, blah, 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 is graffitied. Impossible to miss. Kerry has 2 weeks to show that talks still matter. This item was somewhat abridged, written by Justin Warland, Naples, Italy, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein. Conversation, what you said about delete Facebook. After reading Billy Perigo and Roger McNamee's features in the October 25, November 1 issue, which addressed fallout following the most significant leak of internal research in Facebook's 17-year history, readers shared their frustrations with the social network and social media in general. When sustained, resounding global success is achieved by a single company, we may find ourselves at the mercy of the morality of its leadership, wrote Alan Fedeli of Ringwood, New Jersey. Sarah Bledsoe of Sterling, Colorado, called Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen heroic, but worried about consequences she might face for revealing her identity. She needs our collective prayers for ongoing protection from the harassments she will surely endure for speaking out, she wrote. Citing constant privacy invasions like robocalls, junk mail, and phishing, William S. Rogers of Brentwood, Tennessee, argued, big tech has become too intrusive and needs federal oversight, which Congress seems unable or unwilling to effectively address. On the other hand, Enrique Puertos of Cleveland, Georgia, called for more grassroots activism, writing, the real drivers of change will have to be the conscientious users of these platforms. And Ella Berry of Arcata, California, shared an example of such change. I canceled Facebook many years ago, Berry wrote. I'm here to tell you that you really can live without it. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.